Hi. So, as most of you know, we've been doing a retreat the last 2 days on developing compassion for our wounds, because we all have wounds, and the compassion we give to others needs to include ourselves. If we need to make ourselves another to include ourselves because we were trained, it shouldn't be for ourselves, then make ourselves another. Okay? So, basic Buddhism is, basic premise of Buddhism is that we are basically good. We are fundamentally good. And that there's a joyousness that arises from that goodness. That's our natural state. To be good. And to experience a quiet joy that emanates from that. That's referred to as Buddha nature, or in Sanskrit, Tathagatagarbha. Tathagatagarbha. Right? Tathagatagarbha. Same qualities as the historical Buddha, the Buddha nature, basically good. And unless we can discover the ground of goodness in our own lives, we can't really improve the lives of others. It's not possible. We can't hope to. If we are miserable and wretched, how can we imagine, let alone realize, an enlightened society? How can we do that? Last week when I gave my talk, I passed out two guys from the 10th century who manifest their basic goodness. Hanshan and Chite. Pass them around. Pass them around. Cold Mountain Poems, that's right, Hanshan. And if those guys aren't manifesting the quiet joy that comes from basic goodness, who is? Who is? So this is a tradition. We've been doing this for a few hundred years. Quite a few hundred years. But what happens to us? The inner critic or the inner tyrant interferes with this natural state. And I used to use, say, inner critic, but after meeting with dozens and dozens of people for 16 years, but actually I used to do this way back, maybe 25, 30 years, I renamed the inner critic. And those of you know what I renamed it, who have been with me, the inner tyrant. Because I saw how it preys on people, how it closes them down. How much they suffer from it. Well, what's the deal with the inner critic? What's the deal with the inner tyrant? It's worried about our safety. He or she is worried about our safety. He or she is trying to get us to change so we'll be safe. Because it's a scary world. So we beat ourselves up. For not keeping in shape physically, because our body will fall apart. Beat ourselves up for procrastinating or not following through at work because we're afraid we'll lose our job. We beat ourselves up for not doing enough meditation because we made a commitment to become a Zen priest or something like that. Plenty of stuff to beat ourselves up about, right? And the inner tyrant is pretty merciless. Most inner tyrants I've discovered, really, by meeting with people, day after day, month after month, year after year, pretty merciless. So it covers over our basic goodness. Covers over our basic goodness. Our basic goodness actually allows us to be there for others without losing ourselves. Without losing ourselves. And that's revealed by self-compassion. self-compassion, the practices that we've been doing this weekend, and other types of self-compassion. In my second book, I talk about mirror neurons. And the research has shown that when we're resonating with someone's pain, we may feel it as our own, even if they're not doing anything, even if they're just, cooking the dinner and they haven't said anything to us. Mirror neurons. We have these mirror neurons. And then we can notice about that. They're wonderful that we have that ability to be empathic, but often they're overwhelming. So we tune the other person out who's in pain, or try to fix them, or get lost in their pain. When you tell someone about your pain, notice how quickly they jump in to fix it. Notice that. Because they're uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable. When they tell you about theirs, notice how your own discomfort results in withdrawing, or giving unsolicited advice, or getting entangled in their pain, in their struggle. Notice three different modalities that we use. Some of us use one modality more than the other. So the model that I'm using the last few months is a model of, which comes both out of the Buddhist literature and the Western psychological literature. On the one hand, and I've talked about this in Dharma Talks, on the one hand, the mirror neuron, the eye, can get overwhelmed and entangled in someone else's pain. I don't have a self anymore. I get overwhelmed and entangled in their entanglement, in their confusion. I get lost in it. I call that enmeshed. I get enmeshed. I can't have a self anymore. In my family, maybe I wasn't allowed to have a self. I was taught that I needed to get enmeshed, although my mama didn't say that, but maybe you were taught that. Maybe you were taught that. And then the mirror image of that is disengagement, hiding or running. I can't. I'm getting slurped up. And then you run or hide. Disengagement, their mirror image. And in the middle is engagement. Wherever engagement lies, Buddhist engagement, not just political, but personal. And enmeshment is kind of solid, actually. You just do what other people say, and you're just all entangled with them. You don't have a separate self. It's kind of solid. Also, cutting off is kind of solid. Hiding internally or externally is kind of solid. Engagement's not solid. It's based on don't know. Coming back to just this, don't know. Feel your way along. But it's where your life is, where your vitality is. There's not vitality in either of those others. You may need to do them for a while. It's okay. Sometime when you're in mesh, you need to disengage for a while. That's fine. But you want to come back if you're a practitioner. You want to come back a little bit, at least a little bit. To be engaged, we have to value ourselves. We have to love ourselves. And often we're ridden by shame. Shame. Shame comes from the innocent desire to be loved, to be worthy of affection, to belong. We all need and want healthy attachments. Don't believe this stuff about Buddhists aren't attached. We all need and want healthy attachments. It's important. It's important. That's engagement. Shame is telling us there's something wrong with us that makes us unlovable, and we need to disengage or allow ourselves to be slurped up. We have emotional residue from an earlier experience, and I talked about this in two talks ago. I'll give an abbreviated version. It's hard to give an abbreviated version. My left-handedness. Remember me talking about my left-handedness? So Mrs. Werner in the first grade tried to get me to learn to write with my right hand. But I couldn't do it. But Mrs. Werner insisted I learn to write with my right hand. I went home and told my parents, and my parents went to meet with Mrs. Werner to tell her I was left-handed and I was going to write with my left hand. But I didn't get to go. I was ashamed. My parents had to intervene with my teacher. And this came up for me 16 years ago when I had to start writing on people's rock shoes here. And I saw how beautiful Katagiri had done it. How beautiful everybody did it. Oh, what an aesthetic masterpiece. And I have to do this with my crooked left hand. My shame came up. If someone tells you they're without shame, don't believe them. They are so repressed that they don't know, or they're living in some la-la land. We all have it. We all had experiences from our childhood like that. And it feels permanent and all-encompassing. Guilt is about behavior. Shame is about ourselves. I made a mistake versus I'm inadequate. I'm inadequate as a Zen teacher because I can't do this. When I do this, it's like hieroglyphics. But I do that. That's cool. Cool hieroglyphics. That's what I learned. Why not? Why not? Tim's own version of hieroglyphics. Why not? Wonderful. Wonderful. Shame can paralyze us. Bare awareness practice, which we're doing here, and self-compassion practice, which we do, can help us experience the sadness, the regret, the guilt that we feel without being trapped by shame. Shame is constricting. Shame is dense. Shame is frozen. Shame is crippling. It cripples us. And we've been practicing yesterday how there are negative core beliefs at the root of all shame. Defective, I have a core belief that I'm defective or unlovable or helpless or inadequate or a failure. And we cover those up so we don't even know them. But they're there. They're there. We've covered up our basic goodness through this socialization process, which has its pros, but also has its cons, right? Also has its cons. So because of when we feel ashamed, we want to hide from others and ourselves. I want someone else to ride on the rock suit. Maybe I can hire somebody to ride on the rock suit. A beautiful calligrapher, right? We want to do that. If others knew about our shame, they'd reject us. If you knew about my embarrassment, you'd reject me. But it's common to humanity, you guys, this shame. It's common to humanity. Through bare awareness, non-judgmental awareness, shame loses its power. We all have strengths and weaknesses. We're not worthy or unworthy, good or bad. We have common humanity. So Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, said, when we reflect on what we are doing in our everyday life, we are always ashamed of ourselves. One of my students wrote to me saying, you sent me a calendar and I am trying to follow the good mottos which appear on each page, but the year has hardly begun, and I already have failed. And Suzuki quotes Dogen. Dogen said, Shoshaku Jushaku. Shaku generally means mistake or wrong. Shoshaku Jushaku, Suzuki says, means to succeed wrong with wrong, or one continuous mistake. According to Dogen, one continuous mistake can also be Zen. A Zen master's life, says Suzuki, could be said to be so many years of Shoshaku Jushaku. This means so many years of one single-minded effort. That's the difference. Effort. Not hiding out. Not getting someone else to do the raksu. Not pretending I don't have a hieroglyphic handwriting. But just doing my best. Just doing it. Just making the effort, right? Being authentic. Being real. Just as I am. Then we're not trapped by it. Then we can practice bare awareness of it, kind, gentle awareness of it, and still engage. We can notice what we do well. There are always some things we do well. We just did this self-appreciation exercise for those who were in the room. There are things you do well. There are lots of things you do well. Bring those up. Bring those up. Honor those. Appreciate those. Just because when I write on the rocks, I really do write like this, you guys. If you know, how many of you are left-handed? Oh, yeah. Well, some of you maybe didn't have Mrs. Werner. Since I had Mrs. Werner, I got a really deal here. I was born too early. So we have a common humanity in it, that we all feel this kind of thing. We don't need to feel isolated by our failure. It joins us. Our wounds join us. Our wounds are open to the fresh air. Our wounds are where we connect with people. That's where we connect, in our woundedness. So I think I said to folks yesterday, but I'm actually not sure. I think I did. So I teach mindfulness at work. I taught it twice at St. Thomas. And I had, 75 people come from different workplaces on a Friday. And we did the whole day. Taught them all. I did a lot of guided meditation because, they needed that. But a lot of quiet. No talking, a lot of quiet. So then a CEO friend of mine, I used to be a CEO myself, CEO friend of mine said, I said to him, Greg, I could do mindfulness at work at your place for your senior managers. And he said, no. And I said, why? He said, it'll undermine their motivation. It'll undermine their motivation. So he was afraid that they'd get too laid back. To be too present in the moment, that they wouldn't be striving to exceed the bottom line. They wouldn't be afraid that if they didn't exceed the bottom line, they'd get laid off or get shouted at. This carrot and the stick approach works for a while, but because of fear of failure, it doesn't work in the long run. It doesn't work in the long run. You know that. You know that. Everybody knows that in their heart of hearts, don't you think? So my daughter works closely with top echelon people at Netflix. Netflix has been booming, in case you didn't know. I mean, they're just booming. They're just proliferating. Growing, growing, growing. Well, one of their key things they do is they welcome failure among their all their VPs, all their managers. They welcome failure. And if a manager wants to do something like that Mexico City movie, what was that called? Huh? What was it called?
Roma.
If somebody wants to do Roma, which someone wanted to do, some manager wanted to support the Mexican director, and his supervisor said, no, can't do it. Well, in Netflix, you can just ignore your supervisor because Netflix is set up with the expectation that people will be rewarded for trying things and will be expected to fail sometimes. And my daughter was telling me last week that the COO of Netflix said to her, well, one unit of Netflix, there hasn't been enough failure, as much failure as there needs to be recently. And she said, oh, what do you say that for? He said, well, people learn from their failure. All of our success is due to all of our failure and all the learning we've done with our failures. Sounds a little bit Zen-like, doesn't it? I'm sure they've got lots of other things that are not Zen-like, but that sounds a little Zen-like. That sounds really Zen-like, doesn't it? Really Zen-like. Kindness to ourselves, okay? Rather than self-judgment. Kindness to ourselves. Not I'm bad, but I feel bad right now. Hold that the way you might feel. Hold a baby who's upset. Not I'm an inadequate teacher, but I have this one flaw. And it connects me to my own students, to their flaws. Duh. Seems so simple, and yet, because we're scared, we hide out. We hide out. Open-heartedness to our own shortcomings, our own faults. Turning off the self-critical voice and installing a nurturing one. And actually, we can't turn it off, but we can install a nurturing one, which little by little will override it. And we tend to remember our childhood, and we're not even aware of how much our childhood is in our unconscious, but it's there, and those big people who put us down. In our unconscious, we're remembering that a lot, that we're just kids, and those big people are still putting us down. So our critical parents' voice becomes our own, or our critical principal's voice, or our critical priest's voice, or minister's voice, or a combination of them becomes our own. Relentless and demanding. It's not our basic goodness. Our basic goodness is just here. It's just here. Just present. Right here. Open-heartedness. So in this retreat, we've been practicing identifying our inner critic. Uh-huh. Identifying her. Getting to know our inner critic. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Not easy. The inner critic seems like it's such a natural part of us. And attacks on us by the inner critic seem reasonable and just because we're such screw-ups. Or something, right? But the inner critic sets impossible standards, beats us up for a mistake, blames you when things go wrong, calls you stupid, ugly, and weak, compares you to others, keeps track of your failures, not your accomplishments. Again, keeps track of your failures, not your accomplishments, exaggerates your weaknesses. By paying attention to this voice, and if it's not a voice, it's a feeling. For many people, it's not a voice. It's a feeling. It's a sense. It's in a sense. By paying attention to this sense, you realize it's not really a core part of you. It's something you learned. You're good because you are. You're good because you are. So we can explore the way the inner critic acts like our parents or some authority figure from childhood. We can explore that. We can be curious about that. We can be inquisitive in a non-gentle, judgmental way about that. How does the way we relate to ourselves reflect how these people related to us when we were so little and so innocent? There's a relationship. And of course, you can go into therapy, psychodynamic therapy, and can go way, way into it. But in Zen, we don't necessarily go way into it. We just experience it. Let it be. We notice how the inner critic, we notice how often we hear critical messages in our heads. Do they come up when we're attempting something new? Like riding on my first Roxu? Or when someone's giving us a compliment? Our inner critic comes up and says, don't take that in. You were trained, and you don't take compliments. That's why we just did this exercise in self-appreciation. We probably should do that exercise every day, especially if you are... Now, this is just the research I'm quoting, so don't think I'm biased, although I am biased about everything. But the research says that people who are religious do this more. They put themselves down more. And women put themselves down more. Because of acculturation process. So if you're a woman and you come from a religious background, you have more practice to do. Wow, good for you. You have more practice to do. Good for you. You'll come sit with me more often and I won't be so lonely. Good for you. Notice your inner critic and talk back to your inner critic even, but in a kind, open way. These are just things my dad told me. I don't believe you. These are just things my mom told me. I don't believe you. This is polluting. Please, please stop it. Whatever. You come up with your own words. It's about you, not about me. Coming up with your own words. And I think in my talk before last, I talked about maybe 30 years ago. I don't know how many years ago. My inner critic would come in. You know, when you sit in Zazen a lot, the inner critic can have a field day. In case you haven't noticed that. Just sitting facing a wall, you're giving the inner critic a field day. Inner critic's hungry to straighten you up, right? Because you need a lot of straightening up, and you don't have anything. You're just sitting facing that wall. So the inner critic used to have a field day with poor little Tim. So then Suzuki Roshi would give me this mantra, gate, gate, to repeat. And I changed it to, nice boy, Tim. Nice boy, Tim. Nice boy, Tim. I used that mantra for a long time. And you can find your own mantra. I'm confident you can find your own mantra because you're basically good. You're basically good. Our Zen teachers, our Japanese Zen teachers, gave us no training in self-compassion. But that's okay. They taught us how to do bare awareness. They taught us how to sit. And that's the core of Zen. Emotions are contagious. If you're irritated with your partner or your roommate, your brain, even if you don't say it, your brain is communicating with him or her. And there's a downward spiral. They feel my irritation, and I can't have real intimacy with them unless I have it with myself. I just can't. But self-compassion begins an upward spiral. Activates the reward section of the brain. Oh, again, research. All this research that validating what I've been doing for 50 years, when for so many years I was just considered weird. Pretty cool. Well, I actually kind of enjoyed feeling weird for a while. Actually, in the 60s, I really enjoyed being thought of as weird. But then when it got to be the 70s and 80s, you know, I wanted to get more in the mainstream, I guess. That happens to people, right? No, I think in the 70s, I still enjoyed being weird. By the 80s, I wanted to be more in the mainstream. So if I'm irritated and I have compassion toward myself, then I'm starting an upward spiral in my relationships with others. I'm just starting it. When I meet my own needs for love and acceptance, I'm less demanding of my wife. Isn't that interesting? It's not rocket science, but yet we forget. We forget. And part of self-compassion is compassionate self-soothing. When we're a little baby, little babies, one type of mother picks up the baby immediately when she's crying, soothes her with a voice and touch, ascertains her needs. Does she need milk? Does she need food? Does she need a diaper change? Another type of mother is distracted, impatient. She's suffering. Maybe she's a single mother. Maybe she's bereft of support. She's helpless. And the immediacy of her needs triggers her fears and threaten her. So, the baby's experience is different. The baby feels the mirror neurons too. And most of us have mothers who are somewhat in between. Somewhat in between. But not all of us. But what we're doing now in this practice is mothering ourselves. That's what we're doing, mothering ourselves. Nurturing self-talk. I'm so sorry. I am hurting. Or maybe we can call ourselves a you if we want. I'm so sorry you are hurting. Our compassionate voice. You don't deserve to be hurting. I know how tired and stressed you are. It won't be long until you are finished and can rest. Or whatever. Whatever the nurturing words yourself needs. Whatever. I have confidence that you can discover them. I have confidence in that. Because you're basically good. Already you're good. Underneath, you're good. Underneath and all around. The inner critic, the inner tyrant. You're good. Buddha said, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. So when I taught mindfulness at work 2 years at St. Thomas, people came from different workplaces, 75 people, maybe once, maybe 50 people the other time. And I did lots of different kinds of meditation with them, lots of self-meditation and things. And they said to me, not they, but several came up and said to me at the breaks, but we don't have time to meditate. They said, especially at work, we don't have time. They said, you're an old guy. You don't know what it's like now. That was kind of offensive, don't you think? But I was not offended. I am an old guy. I like being an old guy. I'm an old young guy. I really like that. That's cool. I'm an old young old guy. That's cool. Because of beginner's mind, right? Always the first time. Always the first time. So they don't have time for meditation. So one of the things I was teaching them was taking three breaths, right? I've talked about this before. You know, you have to go to the bathroom sometimes, don't you? You get to go to the bathroom still, don't you? Yeah, you can take three breaths when you go to the bathroom. You can do that. You have to go, you get a break, a coffee break. You have a little time in between meetings. You can put your hand on your desk or on the table, and you can take three breaths. So when I got the avowals at the end, I've done all this stuff with them. What do they like best? What was the most helpful? They said three breaths. Well, I could have done that in 6 minutes instead of 9 hours. Three breaths. What about three breaths as a self-compassion break? What about if you're feeling out of sorts? You notice in your body where you're feeling pain, where you're feeling out of sorts, and you say to yourself, I care about this suffering. May I be free from this suffering. Maybe you hold your own hand. Maybe you hold your own hand. And again, when we're stressed out and feel like we can't have a life of our own, we want to disengage. We want to run. We want to hide. And when you do that, often there's anger. What's anger all about? Usually anger goes along with relationship disengagement. Even if it's just a minute of anger, it's a minute of relationship disengagement. And we all have anger. So it's not like I don't have anger anymore. I'm not saying that. We all have anger. Oh. But how can we be intimate when we're pissed? I mean, really, if I'm pissed at one of you guys, how can I really be intimate with you? I don't think so. I don't think so. When we're rejected or dismissed or just feel cut off, that can linger. That anger can linger for years. Do you find anger coming up from years ago? If you don't, you're really repressed. And you need to maybe talk with a therapist to get unrepressed. Or something. Or just come sit face the wall. That's fine. You know, usually I'm almost by myself here in the morning facing the wall. We have all these people come now. But still in the morning. Maybe we do it too early in the morning. It's like there are three or four of us. I'm lobbying for doing it later, but Buddhists don't like to change, so so here I am. That was a joke, in case you didn't get it. Anger has a positive function. It's showing us that we feel hurt. It's showing us that there's something in our relationship that's not okay, that needs to change. Anger has energy. Determination comes from anger. Determination to protect ourselves. To protect ourselves in threatening or toxic relationship in this moment. In this moment, my wife of whatever it is, 52 or 53 years, is saying something really, really rude to me. My intimacy is gone at that moment. I'm just pissed. It's gone. Well, that's human nature. You think you're going to get over that through meditation? Go meditate somewhere else. And some guru maybe will tell you and get over it. Good luck, honey. Good luck. Tells us we're feeling hurt. Tells us something needs to change. It's got energy. But an unhealthy relationship with anger prevents us from being self-compassionate. We suppress our anger. And that leads to anxiety, emotional constriction, numbness. We may turn it against ourselves. Leads to depression. Turning your anger against yourself chronically leads to depression. There is no doubt about it. Or we can indulge our anger, like someone in my family does who is really working hard on trying not to indulge it. We can continue to feed it by rumination and live in an agitative state of mind. So we're not depressed, we're anxiously depressed. On the DSM-4, there's a DSM-5 now, I've been retired for 3 years. The DSM-4, there's depression, and then there's anxious depression. When anger is no longer helpful, how can we change our relationship to it? Usually we're angry because of our deepest unmet needs. Our unmet needs to be safe, to be connected, to be validated, to be heard, to be included, to be respected, all that stuff, to be loved. That's why we're angry. So through self-compassion practice, we can give ourselves this compassion that we have yearned to receive from others for so long, and we didn't know it. We didn't know even that we yearned for it. But now we know it, and we can begin to give it to ourselves. Because we deserve it. We're basically good, just as we are. And then we can even move beyond self-compassion to self-appreciation, as the exercise spoken guided meditation I was doing this morning. Self-appreciation feels unnatural to a lot of people. Strongly unnatural, again, if you were raised in a religious environment or you're a woman. So you have more opportunity to practice. Cool. I know it's hard, but more opportunity. More likely you're going to make a commitment to your zazen and stick with it. When you get a compliment, does it bounce off? Do you say, yeah, but you helped me the other day, and you helped me even more? Or do you say, oh, thank you, and feel good? Feel good. Wow, I really helped. I really helped Bill. I feel good about the compliment he gave me. I feel good. Can we do that? Well, this is practice. We're practicing doing that so that it becomes natural for us. That's all. We're just practicing so it becomes natural. And we can do that because we're naturally good. We just got all this cultural stuff, all these cultural layers, which have a good side, but they also have an oppressive side. An oppressive side. To give ourselves what we yearn to get from others. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. If you're uncomfortable thinking about your good qualities, if you're afraid to acknowledge your own goodness, why? I got some ideas about why. Some ideas. You don't want to alienate your friends by seeming arrogant. You wouldn't want to seem arrogant, would you? Especially in Minnesota. Maybe in New York, but not in Minnesota, right? Maybe in the New York Jewish community, but not in Minnesota, right? Your good qualities you have, they aren't a problem, so don't focus on them. Just focus on the stuff you've got to change. Oh, that's your inner critic, right? If you acknowledge your goodness, you could do something bad at any time, and then you'd really be in trouble. So you better not acknowledge your goodness now, because you're going to do something bad later, and then you're going to be really, really going down the drain, right? It's safer not to acknowledge it, right? Safer not to acknowledge it. And then finally, you're a bodhisattva. Now, just like in Christianity, there's something like this. I'd have to bring in my grandmother to remember what it is. But there's something like this where you don't appreciate yourself. You just give yourself away. So lots of Buddhists are like this. You're just a bodhisattva for others. Just a bodhisattva for others. Helping others. Just helping others. But you're not really helping others. You're just trying to be good. You're not sinking into your natural goodness. Your natural goodness is already here. This trying to be good is something that got trained, that your inner critic is just demanding that you do. Be good, be good, be good. You're already good. But we're not saying we're perfect. Remember what Suzuki said? We're not perfect. We're not above others. We have weaknesses. We have flaws. We're just good because we are. Discovering our real goodness comes from appreciating simple experiences. This is beginner's mind, which is unburdened by thought. See and feel joyous when we look outside and see the leaves on the trees and the sky behind it. Even if it's raining, we enjoy looking at the rain and how the water drops are there on the leaves, sparkling. That's our goodness. See a bright color. Hear a beautiful sound. We're hearing our own basic goodness. This morning I took a shower. I stepped out of the shower. There was mist all in the room on my body. I saw it. I felt it all in my room. I couldn't see the mirror. That mist, my basic goodness. I appreciated that mist. I'm appreciating my basic goodness. It doesn't take long. It's not a project you have to work on. It's here already. It's here already. We can appreciate the yellowness of yellow, the greenness of green, the purpleness of purple, the redness of red, because we have basic goodness. When we appreciate ourselves and appreciate, we can appreciate all the causes and conditions that came together to help us develop. So we don't need to take our own qualities or deficits personally. We have all these deficits, all these qualities, because of all these causes and conditions. We can just appreciate that. Just appreciate that. Through bare awareness and self-compassion, we can enjoy ourselves as much as those guys. Hold those guys up again, Carrie. Han, Shan, and Shite. You can read about them. They were having a blast. And they still are having a blast. They still are having a blast. And there was a lot of suffering in those times. A lot of people were impoverished. The emperor was not a good guy. If you think Donald Trump is bad, read about the emperor in the 10th century in China. Not a good guy. Not a good guy. So I'm going to close with a quote from Umon from the 9th or 10th century from Blue Cliff Records. Umon addressed his monks. You can all, guys can all be my monks, whether you're all my monks. And said, I'm not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what are after the 15th? So he's saying, I'm not asking you about the last 2 weeks. You know, you're dwelling on that. You're just caught by that. I'm asking you about your next 2 weeks. He says, come and give me a word about those days. The monks say nothing. This usually happens in these Chinese stories and these Japanese stories. The monks say nothing. Well, I think they're a little intimidated. You know, these are cultures that are quite a bit more authoritarian than ours. And I think they're intimidated. But I don't know. What do I know? But it seems to be there. So then Umon says, Yumen. Umon in Japanese, Yumen in Chinese. Yumen says, I'll give the answer to his monks. Every day is a good day. Every day is a good day. The last 2 weeks? The next 2 weeks? How about right now? Appreciation for ourselves, our basic goodness, can only be now. That's where it is. That's where it's hanging out right now. That's where it's hanging out. That's what I want to say. And I went way over time. Bad Tim.
Bad right hand.
Oh, let's hold that right hand. Let's hold our hands together. Support ourselves so we can support others. Okay? Okay. I don't know how much time I have. How much time do I have for Q&A, Carrie? Do I have any time?
I think she'll come down in about 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. 5 minutes. John.
You mentioned how some of the first Japanese teachers who came didn't talk about self-compassion.
That's right.
And I remember another time you mentioned, I don't know if it was Suzuki Roshi or which teacher it was, when they first heard about someone here having self-loathing or not liking themselves, they couldn't
comprehend. That's right.
Now, I know it's universal that we all have an inner critic.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about America in particular that we seem to have more?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. The Dalai Lama also has been puzzled by that. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. Yeah, yeah. But it is true that we do seem to, as Americans, have more of that. Maybe because we are all immigrants. We are all immigrants. We all came to a scary place where we had to protect ourselves, and we counted on our inner critic to deal with all the danger. I don't know. I guess I'd have to go to Australia and see if Australians are like that. But that's my conjecture. We're all immigrants. And this stuff gets passed down from generation to generation. Other people. Yeah. Sarah.
So I wanted to ask, like, how do you think about a person that you perceive as having no shame? You know, like, you're talking about the bad emperor, or, you know, someone who's itching for a war, or something just like, they're doing something that's reprehensible to you.
Yeah.
Feel like they should be ashamed, but...
Yeah. Well, I think two things. You have to protect yourself from their toxicity. You have to protect yourself from their toxicity. And the second is, as you're protecting yourself, you can have some compassion for them because they are really paranoid. They are really afraid. They are really in a knot of need for continual self-protection, continual aggression. But you also have to protect yourself from their toxicity and protect your friends from their toxicity. Both. That's part of being engaged. Does that make sense? And you may even have to be strategic about protecting yourself from their toxicity and get political. Oh, that's good. Get political. Be strategic. but you can still empathize with how afraid they are, how paranoid they are. Thank you.